From the doorstep of the Rocky Mountains, this is Go West Young Podcast, the show about America's public lands and the great outdoors. My name is Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver, Colorado, where our spring snow has given way to some gorgeous sunshine just in time for baseball down the street at Coors Field. On the show this week, Go West Goes East, with the story of a man who lived in the Maine woods alone for 27 years. He didn't talk to anyone, but he survived by stealing what he needed from cabins nearby. It is the incredible story of a guy known as the North Pond Hermit, and we are talking to author Michael Finkel, the only journalist who got to sit down with the hermit during his time in jail. Plus, they called it the Black Blizzard this week in Western history. But first, a quick look at what's making news on our public lands this week. Western members of Congress are fighting back against President Trump's anti-parks agenda. A group of 9 Western senators, led by New Mexico's Tom Udall, warned the president to not try to erase any national monuments from the map. The most at risk are Bears Ears in Utah, possibly Katahdin Woods and Waters in Maine. Of course, a president has never tried to rescind a monument designation before. We talked about why that is a couple episodes ago with a law professor, Mark Squillaci. The whole thing is a great explanation of why it's illegal for a president to try that. We don't know. President Trump might try it anyway, but head back a couple episodes in your feed to listen to that. And also our guest from our last episode, Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva, is having a very busy week right now. First, he joined a lawsuit against President Trump's proposed border wall. He, along with the Center for Biological Diversity, want Homeland Security to conduct a proper environmental review to determine how a wall might impact wildlife along the border. After that, Grijalva demanded answers from the Bureau of Land Management after E&E News obtained a document in which BLM claimed it would prioritize a, quote, backlog of pending oil and gas drilling permits. We dug into that claim. The bottom line is that there is no major backlog. BLM spends more time waiting for oil companies to finish their applications than it does processing them. And oil companies are already sitting on more than 7,500 approved drilling permits that they aren't using today. Finally, Congressman Grijalva, along with other members of the House Natural Resources Committee, released a huge document dump of communications between Interior Department officials and the staff of Utah's congressional delegation and state offices that led up to the designation of Bears Ears. Those documents outright contradict statements from the delegation and the governor, who had before claimed that President Obama declared Bears Ears a monument without consulting them. These email exchanges show staffers for Utah Governor Gary Herbert and Senator Mike Lee were being downright effusive in their praise for interior officials, thanking them for visiting Utah, for providing technical assistance on the Public Lands Initiative bill, and for keeping interior in the loop on conversations they were having with tribes. The bottom line, when you look at the timing of all these emails, is that Interior gave that public lands initiative every chance to succeed. It was only after it became clear that Congressman Rob Bishop wasn't going to bring his bill up for a vote on the House floor, the Senate wasn't going to take it up either, that President Obama decided he had to protect Bears Ears using the only available tool remaining, and that was the Antiquities Act. Our guest this week is a journalist and author who tells the story of a man who lived alone in the Maine woods for 27 years. Christopher Knight was known as the North Pond Hermit, an almost mythical figure, until he got caught in 2013. Michael Finkel is the one reporter who managed to sit down with Knight. His book is called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Michael joins us here in Denver at the tail end of his national book tour. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So his capture made news 4 years ago. You were not based in Maine. You hadn't covered the story. Why did you decide to write to Christopher when you heard about this?
Yeah, so Chris Knight lived in the woods, but he broke into cabins around these ponds in central Maine for sustenance, for some clothing, and as you mentioned, became like this legend. Nobody actually knew if there was one hermit, many hermits. They just gave the label like the North Pond Hermit, but he was literally like the Loch Ness Monster of central Maine, some myth. And when he was captured, literally, he said virtually nothing to the police, but every line he said seemed to boggle the imagination. 27 years in the woods, and not just 27 years in the woods. He said he never once lit a fire, which if anybody knows anything about
in Maine, in the winter.
He said he'd never seen a doctor, never spent any money, never even seen the internet, made a telephone call, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was one other thing that he said that really captured my imagination. He said he stole thousands of books. And, you know, it was a major news event in Maine, and then it went national, and then it went international. And I think you mentioned like 500 journalists descended upon central Maine. From my home in Bozeman, Montana, I just read a piece on the internet from like the Kennebec County Journal of Central Maine. And, you know, as it was maybe five paragraphs long, but every paragraph was increasingly like, wow, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. And then the books thing, you know, sort of like my head like exploded. I was like, my favorite things in the world to do are to camp in a tent and read a book. And this was like the world champion of both of those things.
So you had a pen pal correspondence basically from him with him in jail. And then he suddenly stops writing back. So you decide to get on a plane and fly to Maine basically.
Yeah. So what happened is, you know, I was wondering what Chris Knight would say about, you know, I read this newspaper article. I'm like, you know, what's this guy going to say? How did he survive? Is it even true? Is he crazy? And of course, you know, why would someone go live in the woods for 27 years? And, you know, I waited for a response. And despite all these journalists in central Maine, you know, Chris Knight said nothing. And so I wrote him a letter, as you mentioned, and he surprisingly wrote me back. And even from his first letter, I knew from the first paragraph of his first letter that he was really intelligent. He had an unusual way of using the English language. I guess if you
don't use it,
here's an experiment for anybody. You just go 27 years without speaking and read a couple thousand books and see what happens to your language skills. And he sort of had his own sort of poetry. And we wrote letters back and forth. But as you might imagine, somebody who had just lived with complete autonomy in the forest who's now locked in a cage with another person, though he himself said he deserved to be locked in a cage. He admitted that he was a thief. He didn't try and deny anything, but he was obviously suffering and he stopped writing. And so I decided to take a chance and I flew from Montana to Maine.
And what happens? You walk into the jail and you're hoping he's going to sit down with you?
Yeah, I mean, I was unannounced. I went to the visiting booth. I said, I'm here to see Chris Knight. And I sat in this waiting room and, you know, he had rejected many other people who had attempted to visit. And I didn't know. And then a guard comes in and says, who's here to see Chris Knight? And I stand up and, you know, gives me like an electric wand to see if I have any weapons. And opens this very small visiting booth. And I'm feeling a little nervous. And he closes the door behind me. And there in the visiting booth, sitting behind a piece of a thick bulletproof plexiglass sitting on a stool is Christopher Knight, the legendary North Pond Hermit.
And what does he say, if anything, right there? I mean,
predictably or maybe unpredictably, Chris Knight says nothing. And it was really uncomfortable. You know, when you see another person for the first time, almost, you know, it doesn't matter if you're just about to sit on an airline seat and not talk to the person for the rest of the flight. You nod, you have some sort of human connection. There's eye contact. There's a lot of little unspoken gestures. Well, there was not only no eye contact, no words. It was like as if I wasn't there. So it was extremely uncomfortable at first.
And eventually he opened up at least a bit.
So in pretty much all of the letters that he wrote, Chris Knight said to me, I feel really comfortable in silence. And he also said, I don't really trust people that can't handle silence. And his letters were sort of circulating through my mind as I was in the visiting booth. So I decided I would sit there in silence. And the truth is, when you're right next to somebody, even if there's a piece of glass between you and you're absolutely not saying anything, it's really uncomfortable. I mean, it felt like hours. It was probably 3 minutes. And I'm all like sweaty and like wondering what happening to my facial expressions and feeling really uncomfortable. But on the other side of the glass, Chris Knight, as we were silent for a while, he relaxed and he became calmer. And he eventually started to talk.
Was that a conscious strategy on your part based on the letters, or did it just kind of happen?
I like the way you grant me like I'm actually strategizing as you know. I really appreciate your thinking that I'm really that prepared. No, it's like, I mean, I love being a journalist and it's just a feel, and you know, half the time I'm wrong and half the time I'm right with my instincts. But yeah, I just felt like this in the moment, I should just be quiet and see what happens.
So this story was originally a magazine piece for GQ that you wrote back in 2014. Many of us here in the office remember that when it came out. It was a very riveting read. At what point did you realize that there was more here, that there was a book waiting to be told and not just a magazine piece?
I mean, long before the magazine piece, It was literally from the first couple of letters where, as I mentioned before, like this, you know, as a journalist and writer, I'm susceptible to one who uses language beautifully. And just the opportunity, I think humans have been really we have been interested in people who have separated themselves from society. I mean, this is like a fascination that goes back to basically the beginning of recorded history, 5,000 years. Oh, guru, what do you have to say about the world? And I tumbled right into that obvious fascination. And just the fact that here's a guy who removed himself, like, as hard as this is to believe, like as profoundly as any known person in all of history, and clearly had a brain, a great mind on his shoulders, I could tell from right away, like, and had an incredible story. It's not just solitude, it's also survival. And then there's this true crime aspect and how other people feel about it. I knew that this was richer than a magazine article pretty much right away. I still felt sort of an obligation to fulfill my promise to GQ, but I knew long before that this surpassed the boundaries of a magazine article.
One of the first things that struck me about your descriptions of Chris, he didn't think of himself as a hermit, and he certainly didn't look like what you would expect a hermit to look like when you hear the words hermit in the woods.
So Chris Knight is this outlier on so many ways, and I'm just thinking what he would say listening to this conversation. And, we want to put a label. Oh, you're a hermit. You're this. And, Knight had this way of expressing when a comment or a question I had was, let's just say, stupid. He would like give me this sort of long, disappointing blink. The thing is, and like it's very, I've never encountered anyone so unusual as Chris Knight, but he would say that trying to put a label on him was just a fool's errand. Like he never put a label on anything he did, that's something like to the outside world. Yeah, he admitted to me that the word hermit fit him well, but he never once thought of himself as a hermit, despite sort of being the quintessence of such a thing. He put no label on what he did. He didn't really think about the outside world. And I'm not really expressing it with the beauty that he expressed. I tried to capture his poetry in the book. I'm doing as best I can to sort of interpret it here in our conversation.
So you mentioned human contact was hard for him. Conversation obviously was. But at the same time, in this internal world that he had, he was very well read. He kept up on current events. He had a radio. Is this just someone who was most comfortable living inside himself? Is that the ultimate why that you were trying to get at here?
Yeah, I think that's like the ultimate question. Why would someone remove themselves so profoundly? And it's hard to get your head around because humans are really, really social creatures. Like we do not like to be alone with ourselves. It's like, if you really ask what's the longest time you've ever spent by yourself, I'm not talking about like not seeing anyone, no phone calls, no text messages. More than 90% of everyone have never gone a single day alone. It's just not, it's not what we're wired to do. But there have been, like throughout human history, a very thin percentage of people who have felt the need to be away from everyone else. And Chris Knight was this person. And I asked him, did you commit a crime? Was there abuse in your family? Were you confused about your sexuality? Something. And he gave me the long blink, like that was a stupid question, because none of those things really keep you away for that long. He felt this, he was never comfortable with other people, being around other people, and he felt this very strong internal tug. I think he described it like a gravitational pull to leave the world. And he had this very radical idea for how to live. And he basically fulfilled his ideal of life more fully than most of us probably ever will.
So the book, I appreciate, goes back and forth between trying to answer this possibly unanswerable why and the much more answerable how he lived in the woods. And the how is fascinating. Besides the break-ins that you talk about, I mean, he's still living alone in the woods in Maine through winters. You went and saw his camp a couple months afterwards. Describe for us how he lived, because this is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, there's a lot of remarkable elements. And I wanted to just touch a little bit more on the why. He left because he felt this internal tug, but he stayed because, I mean, what are we really all looking for in life? I mean, it's, you know, even you can read life, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He stayed because, well, I mean, I think we're going to talk about some suffering, but he stayed in the woods because he was really content. He was happy. Like, he loved it there, frankly. I mean, when I saw him describe, well, you know, I'm like, what did you do this whole time? You know, he said he was really at peace and really just pleased with his life. And so that's the reason why he stayed. He left because he felt this tug, and he stayed because he was happy. It seems like completely simple, but kind of profound. So his sight in the woods, this is kind of, this is like another mind-blowing aspect. He didn't live in the great north woods of Maine, which you might imagine. He lived kind of like in rural Maine. There were like dirt roads around his site. He was on private property, a 200-acre lot, but still private property. There were 300 cabins, mostly summer cabins, within a couple of hour walk from where he lived. He was basically, there were towns surrounding him. And I was like, I cannot understand. Everyone has their own like point of, this is my point of disbelief. Mine was, how could a guy camp in the woods pretty much like in the middle of a rural area and never be found for 25 years. It took him a couple of years to find this site. So I went into the woods to find his site. And I'm telling you, within like 3 minutes of being in the woods near Chris Knight's site, I understood. I spent most of my life in Montana. We have the Lodgepole Forest. They're wide open, especially in winter. You can see there's game trails everywhere. Like, you can see. Well, this forest in central Maine, it was like walking in a Brillo pad. I have never experienced like such disorientation. I was disoriented. I was I didn't know which direction I was going in, which was really bizarre to me. There was no trails. There's so much downfall. I sounded like a bull in a china shop walking through there. And I'm a decent hiker. And this guy had found this clearing in this incredibly dense forest, which was also chalked with boulders left over from the last ice age. You really could not move through there without making a ton of noise. And this man was able to walk through the forest silently without even leaving a footprint, and had found this clearing in this horrific woods. And when I eventually came across it, it was, you know, I'm like listening to the angels sing in my head. And I was like this, you've walked into this room in the forest. And it was truly magical. I spent the night there 5 times. I visited it 8 times, and I understood how Chris was never found, and I understood why it brought him such pleasure. I think we should all hang out in his site in the woods for a couple of minutes. I think the world would be a better place.
If it wasn't only on private property.
I know. I feel sorry for the landowner.
Yeah. But I mean, this was built out. He put in a subfloor. He put in a landfill.
Yeah. Let me say something about Chris. When I spoke with him, you know, there was, you know, in jail, there's a piece of glass between us, and his phones are scratchy. He's an awkward person, and it was an awkward situation. But even with all those givens, he clearly had an incredible mind. He said he didn't have a photographic memory. He just remembered everything. He could quote from any of the thousands of books he read. And, you know, whenever he mentioned a book I read, I would say, oh, yeah, I read that. And he would mention something, oh, Memoron chapter 3 and that. And I would be like, no. I don't. Sorry. But he also knew, we could talk theoretical physics. He knew how to fix everything from electrical to automotive. He had like a great mind. So he figured, I mean, he left the world at age 20 and never got advice from an elder again after age 20, which is kind of hard to imagine. I'm like 48 years old and I still talk to my dad for advice every once in a while. And he just was able to solve all sorts of problems. Like you mentioned, the subflooring, you know, no forest floor is perfectly level, especially one in the woods where Knight was. And every time he finished reading like magazines or books, he would bury them just below the surface and made like a perfectly flat platform for his tent. And it also aided with a rainwater drainage at the same time.
And he shaved. He had a working kitchen. He ate lots. I don't know if you could say he ate well given his diet, but he wasn't most of the time hungry for food. I mean, he lived a relatively, I guess you could say, normal life for a guy living alone in the woods, breaking into cabins for food.
Despite the fact that it was completely unique life. It was no. In terms of the how, the number one question I had for him was, how did you survive the winters in Maine without lighting a fire? I mean, I'm not going out there for one, I'm not going out there for 3 hours in winter without a fire. I mean,
and you're talking about, you know, well below zero for weeks at a time.
It's like, well, it's like negative 20 there and it's wet cold. It is like, I've spent a lot of winters in Montana and I know cold, but I'm telling you, those Maine winters are incredible. And that, so I said to him, you know, I really was into like the nuts and bolts of how he survived. I said, you must have just wrapped yourself in a ton of sleeping bags and, you know, just did this sort of human hibernation because he was so adamant about not leaving footprints, or he would like stockpile his camp with food, or he would steal a bunch of food in November and ideally would never leave his tiny site in the woods for almost 6 months. He wouldn't leave. And so I imagined this sort of human hibernation. And once again, with a dumb question, you know, he would give me the long blank and say, and that was completely wrong. Now, Chris Knight, he didn't know what year it was without thinking about it. He wasn't even sure of the decade, but he knew the hour and the minute. He stole some watches. And he told me that every night in winter, he got up at 2:30 in the morning, which is the depth of cold, which was the time that you or I would probably huddle ourselves most deeply. But he knew that's when hypothermia starts. And once that cold starts marching from your fingertips to your heart, it's almost unstoppable. You'll die. He got up at 2:30 in the morning, paced the perimeter of his camp. Just imagine this. All night, every night, all winter, for 27 winters, and never lost a finger or a toe or so much as a toenail to frostbite.
And it's not like he was a survivalist before this. He wasn't a camper. He'd taken a moose. He won a moose tag when he was a kid. But this all came to him either instinctively or through trial and error.
He was also brought up in an unusual family, a very private family with not very much money, but an interesting family, like highly intellectual. They read Shakespeare and Edna St. Vincent Millay at night, and the father made sure they all knew how to fix cars and could repair electrical things. The family studied thermodynamics. You know, he was blessed with an amazing head to solve problems. You know, sometimes people mention Chris McCandless, the protagonist of Into the Wild, and I don't like to make the comparison, but McCandless did not survive one winter. Chris Knight came out after 27 winters strong as an ox.
The other part of the creativity then, I guess, is the law breaking, the burglary. He was a very, very talented burglar.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, in addition to like the most amazing feat of solitude, and like even if he was with three other people, it would be like a survival story like no other. There's also this incredible true crime aspect. The guy was, he had a code. Now, he allowed himself to break into cabins, but he would never shatter a window or kick down a door. He had this Houdini-esque ability to pick locks. Even the police officers that were chasing him, and literally they looked for him for 27 years, had to acknowledge their admiration for his ability to not only pick a lock, but have a, like, leave the crime scene completely, like, pristine. He wouldn't touch your television or your jewelry or your computer. He would take your Stephen King novel and your hamburger meat and your flashlight. And one of my favorite little tidbits is when he left your cabin, he would make sure to set the front door lock so it locked behind him because, you know, there's thieves out there.
And I mean, he'd talked about, you know, he was mainly there for food. He'd clear a family out of their freezer full of frozen chickens, but other than occasionally thawing some food in the microwave in winter, he was very patient, would wait for his stuff, go in, get out, borrow but not steal a canoe to get back. I mean, the level of focus and patience to pull this off, in his estimation, 1,000 times.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little Chris Knight voice going on in my head right now, so I feel like I have to like share a message from Chris Knight. You know, he always... I feel warmly about him, and I sometimes speak warmly about him. I tried to take a little more neutral stance in the book. He told me, I'm just like listening to his voice, don't romanticize me, Mike, he would say. You know, you have to take the good with the bad. You know, another aspect of this story, amongst the myriad others we touched upon, is how people felt about him. And despite the fact that he only took hamburger meat and books, he broke into people's cabins. He stole people's peace of mind and their sense of security, which you really can't put a price tag on. You can get 10 years in the state penitentiary for entering a house uninvited and taking nothing.
Unsettling.
For the homeowners. So some people around in the ponds of Central Maine hated this man. They detested him. They thought he should be put in jail for the rest of his life. Other people said after the first break-in, he was no more trouble than the seasonal houseflies. And in fact, if they had caught him in the act, they would have let him go. And this, nobody had a neutral opinion, but there was like, why? It almost reminded me of like political debates. I wonder if that's happened in the United States recently, but like some families were actually split in half too. So I'm like, I loved him. He was no problem. I hated him. You know, it would be, and I found that how people reacted to Chris Knight was really an interesting aspect. And it said almost as much about you as it did about him.
So how did this all finally unwind? How did he finally get caught after 27 years?
Yeah. So he was this mythological figure, but it's sort of like his crimes were like the police and the game warden and the sheriff's department. They looked in on him, but these crimes sort of fell in the crack between being like kind of not serious enough and kind of too serious. Anyway, it took an obsessive person to catch another obsessive person. And it was a game warden named Terry Hughes. And he's like Law and Order man to the nth degree. Like he's like, this isn't the Loch Ness Monster. Things are really missing from cabins and somebody is doing it and I'm going to figure it out. And I'm not going to get into the weeds here describing it, but suffice it to say he went to like Homeland Security and put like electric eyes and had buzzers ring into his cell phone. He got obsessed with catching the guy, and it took like another great mind and another great outdoors person to catch him, and he caught him. And the thing that I find most fascinating is here's like this straight-laced Law and Order guy who nabs someone. The guy immediately confesses to everything, 1,000 felonies to this police officer. And when he hears his story and follows him back into the woods to his site and sees the way he walks through the woods, the arresting officer is like the only human being ever to witness Chris Knight walk in the woods. And I interviewed him and his face just was like, I've like seen the most amazing forest walker. No wonder I couldn't track him. He like didn't break a branch. He didn't leave a footprint. He bound from rock to root to rock and like moved through the forest like a cat. And the guy told me, he's like, you know, I'm a Law and Order guy. I'm a, you know, old school Marine. I wanted to hate this guy and I just couldn't. He felt warmly about Chris Knight too, even the arresting officer.
It's an admiration. It's an admiration I hear in your voice, and I think anyone who spends time outdoors can appreciate that. Someone who is that at home in nature, and that may be part of why so many of us in the office here are fascinated with this story. It's not Western, but you're here on our podcast because it draws, I think, talk to Westerners in that way. And you're from Montana originally. Is there something cultural there between Montana and the Mainers? Is there some sort of cultural kinship?
Yeah, I spent about 25 years of my life, so the majority of it in and around Bozeman, Montana. And it's funny, I went to Central Maine and I felt really at home. I mean, let's just think about it. It's like rural, cold, and you know, it's the type of place where like Montana, Maine, you put your car in the ditch, the next car coming is going to help you out. It's just the Western way, you know, that because it's next time it's you that goes in the ditch. You know, it's like, when I rented a car in Portland, Maine, and I saw a Massachusetts plate, I went right back to the rental agency. No, I need Maine plates. It was like, you know, I know I've spent enough time in Montana. You just go up to a small town bar and you're already two steps behind if you got the wrong license plate, you know, and it's the type of thing where you don't just burst in and start asking questions. There's the polite, let's have a cup of coffee and get to know each other before we start asking questions. And I just felt at home, and there's this real love and acknowledgement of the outdoors. I found that the people who really, this is a slight generalization, but the people who disliked Chris Knight were really not the Central Mainers. They were the people who
were the Bostonians.
I didn't say that.
I did.
But okay. You know, I love the Bostonians, but I'll just pretend. I'll silence his consent, perhaps. The real Mainers were like, I tip my cap, man. I know how cold it is. It was like, there is this understanding that yes, again, I'm speaking warmly, and I think you'll have to decide whether the book is any good. But books that I like, you know, don't tell you how to feel. And I try to present Chris Knight exactly as he is. And if you read the book and you don't like him at all, that is not wrong. But I'm trying not to tell you how to feel. I personally, like, you know, here we are at the podcasting, so I can speak from the heart a little more. But he was an outdoorsman extraordinaire. He did know how to hunt and fish. He compared himself often to animals. And he did so in, he meant that as a compliment to himself. He said, like, you know, before winter came, I fattened myself up. I took, you know, you take the cues, everyone from, you know, mice to the moose, everyone fattens themselves up, bears. And he didn't quite hibernate, but he basically stayed in his den all winter. And why did he steal? Well, the same reason when I leave my garbage cans out in Bozeman and a bear goes through it, why isn't that bear going foraging for berries? Efficiency. When you live in a really cold environment, as we outdoors people know, you know, you use a lot of energy. And when you're living there week and month, you need to conserve your energy, especially in winter where your fat stores are vital. Like, he was at the verge of life and death a few times. It was just efficient for him to take from cabins. He knew it was wrong. He was never morally comfortable with it, but the man is the type of person, as you probably can imagine after this conversation, where once he made a decision, he would, like, I've decided I will steal from second homes. I will never smash windows. I will never disturb anyone. He would rather die than break his rules, but his rules allowed him to steal. It was efficient. He couldn't have survived without it.
And maybe some of that comes from his family, which you've had a couple of very brief interactions with them, but they are not certainly the most social family. But they also struck me as a family that would not be out of place in rural Montana or in northern Idaho. He picked that up, you know. I guess that's part of who he is and what his family instilled in him.
Well, the family, he was actually, once he was caught, he begged the arresting officers not to tell his family that he was still alive. And they said, well, why? He said, well, I was brought up not to steal. And they were that kind of family, morally, you know, they learned everything, but they were morally proper. And he said he was ashamed that he had become a thief.
But they'd also never reported him missing after 27 years.
You know, confounding, you know, item number 7,006 in this is like, why didn't his family, you know, file a missing persons report? I have three young children. One of them is missing for 3 hours. I'm going to have helicopters out. You know, it's like, so I asked the local police officer in central Maine where the family's from, like, aren't you surprised they didn't call the police? And he said to me, oh, no, not at all. This is a very keep to themselves family that doesn't want to air their dirty laundry. He was 20 years old, which is considered an adult in the Knight family. And he clearly had done something voluntarily. He never told his family. They suffered. I asked, you know, why didn't you send a postcard, a phone call? Why didn't you tell them that you were alive? And we haven't gotten into the depth of his solitude. He really wanted to be alone, unconnected. Just one phone call, and then suddenly there's a lifeline out there. There's a connection. He wanted to sever all connections, and unfortunately, his family suffered.
His father died while he was in the woods.
15 years after he disappeared, and Chris was still listed as a survivor on the obituary. Clearly, the family didn't know what to do or how to categorize him.
He was sentenced to basically time served, 7 months. How is he doing now, as far as you can tell?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, another thing I was curious about, besides how did you survive and why did you leave, another interesting thing is what happens to a person who's been completely alone for so long? I mean, the heart of your life, imagine 20 to 47, that's basically, before that you're a kid, and after that you're sort of an old man. What happens to that, such a person who's thrust back into society? I mean, it's such a mystery. And I'm tempted to say, read it in the book and find out, but I'm feeling kind of generous right now. Yes, the state of Maine was really, I'd say lenient, you know, 7 months.
7 months for 1,000 burglaries.
But even the prosecuting attorney, the district attorney, is like, it's clearly, jail is clearly not the right punishment for this guy. He's such an outlier. And so he was given very strict probation, where if he broke his probation anyway, he could get 7 years in the state penitentiary. And by the way, hasn't broken it at all, has observed it to the letter, as people expected. He's an introvert, not really a hardened criminal. There was a great concern that he would either escape back to the woods or possibly commit suicide. It was very, very worrisome for a while. And I'm invested in Chris Knight and his story. He gave me his story and asked for nothing in return. And that's quite a gift. I'm happy to report that the ending is, let's just say, moderately upbeat. He will probably never capture the joy he felt and the freedom he felt in the forest, but he has carved out for himself like a quiet, anonymous life in central Maine.
This is, I imagine, you know, such a rip-roaring tale, there must be some interest in this from Hollywood types. Is he someone who would even entertain that?
No.
No. He's ready for the solitude again.
I mean, so I told you he gave me his story and asked for nothing in return. That wasn't quite accurate. He asked for something in return, which was for me to leave him the heck alone and everyone else. In addition to all the ways that Chris Knight was really intelligent, he had like great game theory in mind. He realized that he would be hounded for the rest of his life for the story, being the 500 journalists that came down, and figured that if he told his story to one person, he told me exactly what he wanted to tell me and no more. I worked on this book for 3 years, but it's only 191 pages long. This is no great tome because there were things he didn't want to talk about, and there's no cajoling a man who could be silent for 27 years into saying what he doesn't want to say. He realized if he told one person his story, he could kind of, it's counterintuitive, but he could actually regain his privacy, because if someone wants to know what he has to say, there it is. He could just shove this book in their face and he can retreat. He has like built the book as sort of his defensive ramparts. Like, and he basically expressed that to me, like, here's my story, get lost and tell everyone else not to bug me. They can see what I've told you.
Ultimately, are you personally satisfied with his explanation of why? Or if you could play psychiatrist, get him on the couch, get into somewhere deep in his brain, is there something you would want to know 5-10 years down the road if you had the chance to talk to him again?
Well, something, you know, the nice part about being a journalist and encountering someone like Chris Knight is I just really, whatever sort of happens was so fascinating to me. I mean, of course there are endless amount of questions, but you know, did I want to psychologically analyze them? Yeah, but I talked to dozens of mental health professionals, and as with so many things, he's literally uncategorizable. And in fact, you know, there are many times I'd say, like, let's just say like twice a day, you know, I got these three little kids. I'm like, I'm driving in my car. Two of them are screaming in the back seat. Like, six text messages are coming through my phone. I'm late to an appointment, stuck in traffic, and I'm listening to the political news on the radio. And I'm like, I'm losing my mind. And I really think, you know, it's not Chris Knight. It's who's crazy. It's the rest of us.
The book is subtitled "The Story of the Last True Hermit." Do you think there could be other Christopher Knights out there somewhere else, some other people who have so pulled back from society but are still out there on their own, either in Maine, in the Louisiana backwoods, in Montana? Or is this something that he was uniquely capable of doing?
Yeah, I fully admit that the only slightly hyperbolic line in the whole book happens to be printed on the cover. Is it possible that there is another hermit who has been hidden for 27 years? It's possible. It's highly unlikely. Man, I mean, there's 7 billion people on the planet. This is the age of Facebook and Twitter. It's shocking to me that anyone could be gone for like a weekend. So it's kind of fun to imagine, though, that there's another Chris Knight out there now that Chris Knight has been brought back into society. And then maybe there is someone in Alaska. Maybe they're even listening to this podcast and sort of nodding, thinking, oh, second to last true hermit.
How is this book, how has knowing Chris changed you when you're out camping, when you're taking the family out, or when you're out by yourself? How has this experience changed you?
Chris Knight had a really fascinating relationship with time. I feel like we are all like on this crazy schedule, and Chris Knight sort of was able to, I'm wondering how to describe this. His poetry was so beautiful. He was like out of time. He often just lived absolutely in the present moment, what the Buddhists often call mindfulness, which is an amazing state to access. I think I've done it for like 17 seconds in my life, and would say things like, you know, hey, let's stop talking now and let's talk again and come back in a couple of years. I'm like, a couple of years? I'm like, I'm on a deadline. I got this. I got bills to pay and this. But, you know, we don't really take very much time to just like, you know, the cliche, stop and smell the roses, or just time to do nothing. I mean, you know, he read books and he listened to the radio and he, He had a few even Game Boys, but for the majority of Chris's time in the woods, he did what we would call nothing. He found it utterly fulfilling and fascinating. And, you know, I got to tell you, I mean, there's been, this isn't just me. There's been like dozens of studies that show that just quiet time makes you calmer, more relaxed, healthier, and smarter. Like, who hasn't like taken a look at society? Let's just say the last couple of months, like we could all use a 15-minute chill session every day. I think the world would be a better place. So yeah, really, he really affected my, like how I think about my schedule and my time. Let's all just ease off just a touch. And maybe we don't have to do 27 years, but if we can all take a little soupçon of Chris Knight, I think we'd have a better planet.
I love it. Michael Finkel is the author of The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Available at your favorite bookstore right now. Michael, thank you for stopping by the podcast.
Did my pleasure. Thank you.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky. You could see
that is our old friend Woody Guthrie singing about the Black Sunday dust storm of April 1935. They called it the Black Blizzard. The photos of it are terrifying. An estimated 300 million tons of topsoil rolling across the Oklahoma Panhandle, down into Texas, and then across the Southwest. The dust was thick enough to suffocate people. It killed birds and rabbits that couldn't outrun it. Later that year, Congress passed the Soil Conservation Act, which provided guidance to farmers and landowners, helping them reduce soil erosion and improve forest and field health. The Soil Conservation Service, which was created by the act, exists today as the Natural Resources Conservation Service. It is one of the agencies that President Trump has targeted for severe budget and staffing cuts in the coming year.
From Albuquerque and Clovis and all New Mexico, they said it was the blackest that ever they had seen.
That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It is the best way for new listeners to find us. And we love getting email as well. podcast@westernpriorities.org is where to send it. You can subscribe to the show, of course, on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. On behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks so much to our guest this week, Michael Finkel. My name is Aaron Weiss. Thanks for listening.
We're huddled into their oil boom shacks, and the children, they was crying as it whistled through the cracks. And the family, it was crowded into their little room. They thought the world had ended, and they thought it was their doom. Storm took place at sundown, it lasted through the night. When we looked out next morning, we saw a terrible sight. We saw outside our window where wheat fields they had grown was now a rippling ocean of dust the wind had blown. It covered up our fences, it covered up our barns, it covered up our tractors in this wild and dusty storm. We loaded our jalopies and piled our families in. We rattled down that highway to never come back again.